The concept of motive is central to the criminal justice system. Black's Law Dictionary defines motive as cause or reason that moves the will and induces action, an inducement, or that which leads or tempts the mind to indulge a criminal act. People commonly conflate criminal intent and motive, but Black's Law Dictionary defines the difference between the two. It notes that, in law, there is a distinction between them. Motive is the moving power which impels to action for a definite result. Intent is the purpose to use a particular means to effect such result. The idea of motive as a moving power goes all the way back to the origin of the word. It traces its roots all the way back to the old French word motif, which meant having control of motion, causing motion, having power to move someone or something. In the prosecution of C.J. Rice, both the modern meaning of motive and the old French meaning of motif come into play, both in his initial trial and his recent exoneration. But the discovery that led to C.J. being set free wasn't done by a lawyer. Instead, it was found by one of my students at the University of South Carolina School of Law. This discovery was a needle in a haystack that she found while working on another innocence case that we were working. And now, that student is a public defender, and both of the men that she helped exonerate are on the path to becoming lawyers themselves.
Hi, and welcome back to Undisclosed, Toward Justice. I'm Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and advocate. I'm here with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm a professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog. On the evening of September 3rd, 2011, C.J. Rice and his friend Tyler Linder were riding their bikes near the intersection of South 4th and Wharton Streets in South Philadelphia. The block was filled with brownstones, and on the corner was the yellow awning for Castillo Grocery Store. C.J. was 17 years old at the time. He had grown up with his mother in a high-crime neighborhood after the death of his father. During his youth, C.J. had a few interactions with juvenile justice for minor drug offenses, nothing serious. For the most part, he kept his nose clean. And C.J. was smart. He had been on the honor roll in high school, and he had two options on the horizon as graduation loomed. The first was going to Howard University in Washington, D.C., widely regarded as the top historically black college or university in the country. And the second was enlisting in the Army to serve his country. C.J. had been in discussions with a recruiter, with the question being whether the military or a college education would be his gateway into adulthood. But all of these future plans were about to be derailed. As C.J. rode his bike, he noticed a car driving up behind them. According to C.J., it was a car he didn't recognize with tinted windows. As the car drove by, someone stuck their arm out of the window and fired a gun at C.J. and his friend Tyler. None of the bullets fired struck Tyler, but three of them hit C.J. One hit him in the left buttocks, a second one hit him in the left flank, and a third bullet struck C.J. in the stomach. C.J. has said that it felt as if the left side of his body had been pinched, then bludgeoned by a crowbar. C.J. was taken to the Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, where it was determined the bullet to the stomach had done the most damage. This was discovered when the doctor did exploratory surgery. This consists of the doctor doing an incision from CJ's breastbone down to his pelvis, sticking his hand in and moving his hand all around to find the bullet and the extent of the damage. This led to the discovery both of the bullet and severe trauma to CJ. The bullet had damaged his stomach, his large intestine, his small intestine, and his pelvis. Specifically, CJ was diagnosed with a comminuted fracture of his pelvis, meaning it was broken in three places or more. It's the type of serious injury that you see after a car crash, a far fall, or as here, a gunshot wound. After this exploratory surgery, CJ had a 10 to 11 inch long incision on the front of his body that was closed with more than 30 staples. In essence, these staples were holding CJ's abdomen together. After this surgery, CJ had a rough recovery that was worsened by a bout of pneumonia. As a result, he had difficulty sitting up and lying down, needed assistance to do even basic tasks, and walked hunched over and with a hobbled gait.
While CJ was recovering, the police investigated the shooting. On September 16th, 13 days after the shooting, CJ was interviewed by detectives with the Philadelphia Police Department. He told them that he was unable to identify either the car or the shooter. According to CJ, he thought that the shooting was a case of mistaken identity. But the police had their own theory. They thought the shooting was gang-related, and they got a tip from an anonymous source that the person who had shot CJ was someone named Khalif Ladson. Now, three things are notable about this. First, CJ and Khalif had been friends growing up through middle school. They had grown apart, but there is no evidence in the record of animosity between the two of them. Second, no one has ever identified the anonymous source who gave the police the tip about Khalif being the shooter, and no one, including Khalif, has ever been arrested or charged with CJ's shooting. And third, there is no evidence that the police told CJ that Khalif was a suspect in his shooting, and there's also no evidence that CJ had any independent knowledge of this investigation. 4 days after this police interview, CJ went to see his doctor, Theodore Tapper. Dr. Tapper was a pediatrician who had first seen CJ when he was 1 day old and served as his doctor throughout childhood. When Dr. Tapper saw CJ on September 20th, 2011, he was in the early stages of recovering from having the 30-plus staples removed from his abdomen. According to Dr. Tapper, CJ was in obvious pain and walked gingerly, like an old person. Dr. Tapper asked CJ what he had been prescribed for his pain, and CJ responded that he had been given Percocet, but wasn't taking it because he didn't like the way it made him feel. And given the oxy epidemic that raged across the country, this was likely a good call. During CJ's recovery, he wasn't living with his mom. While CJ thought the shooting was a case of mistaken identity, his mom was concerned for his safety. And so she sent CJ to stay with his godmother, Dina Duncan, and her teenage son, Qaddafi Malone, in West Philadelphia. And both Dina and Qaddafi would testify to the same things as Dr. Tapper, that CJ was in a lot of pain, needed a lot of assistance, and could barely walk. So all of this sets the stage for the night of September 25th, 2011, 5 days after CJ was seen by Dr. Tapper. And now we're back in South Philadelphia, where CJ was shot, but a decent distance from where he was living with his godmother in West Philadelphia. Specifically, let's take you to the 1600 block of South 18th Street. 18th Street is a north-south street that is intersected by Fernand Street and East-West Street. And on that block was the brownstone where Khalif Ladson lived. Now, as you might recall, Khalif was a suspect in the shooting of CJ, although he was never arrested or charged with a crime. On the night of September 25th, Khalif was outside the brownstone with several family members, including his mother, Latisse Johnson, and his 7-year-old brother, Kair, and Latisse's 6-year-old niece, Deenan Thomas. On the day of the shooting, Latisse and the family had gone to the hospital to visit her children's father, who was battling brain cancer. Meanwhile, Deenan, that 6-year-old niece, also had a brain tumor that would likely be fatal, although it looked like she would be accepted into a program at St. Jude's for experimental treatment. But Deenan would never get that treatment due to what happened on the night of September 25th. On that night, Latisse was sitting on the stoop in front of a brownstone with three other family members waiting for a food delivery that was supposed to come at 9:30 p.m. But before the food arrived, two men rounded the corner from Fernand Street, walked to the curb across the street from the brownstone, and opened fire. With the bullets flying, Latisse's son, Kair, tried to open the door, but bullets were firing in rapid succession. Eventually, he got the door open and the family spilled in. Kair saw that 6-year-old Deenan had been shot 3 times in the leg and thought she was going to die. Latisse quickly called 911, and all she said was that the two shooters were wearing hoodies. She didn't give any indication that she knew who the shooters were. Police officer Charles Forrest was the responding officer, and he arrived and waited for the ambulance to no avail. While they waited, Latisse explicitly told Officer Forrest that she couldn't identify the shooters. Eventually, not willing to wait for an ambulance any longer, Officer Forrest got the victims in a squad car and took them to Children's Hospital himself. Only then did Latisse and Khalif notice that they had been struck by bullets as well. Luckily, maybe due to Forrest's decision to drive the victims to the hospital, all of their injuries were quickly treated and none of them were especially serious. While at the hospital, Latisse told nurses that she could not identify the shooters. And she told the doctors that she hadn't even seen the shooters. Instead, she said she heard the gunshots and then was able to escape inside the home with her family. Latisse was also interviewed by police officers at the hospital. She told them that there were two shooters. One was a black male wearing a gray hoodie and the other was wearing a black hoodie. According to Latisse, both were wearing black sweatpants. Finally, Latisse said she saw the black male in the gray hoodie quickly run from the scene after the shooting.
Like many of you, I make New Year's resolutions every year. And toward the top of my list is always getting a life insurance policy. But when you're balancing one full-time job of being a law professor with a second full-time job of doing undisclosed, and then you add all the hoops you have to jump through to get life insurance, well, you know what John Steinbeck says about the best laid plans. Well, Fabric by Gerber Life is term life insurance you can get done today. Made for busy parents like you, all online, on your schedule, right from your couch. You can be covered in under 10 minutes with no health exam required. Fabric has flexible, high-quality policies that fit your family and your budget, like $1 million in coverage for less than a dollar a day. And there's no risk. There's a 30-day money-back guarantee, and you can cancel at any time. They have over 1,900 five-star reviews on Trustpilot with a rating of excellent. Join the thousands of parents who trust Fabric to help protect their family. Apply today in just minutes at meetfabric.com/justice. That's meetfabric.com/justice. meetfabric.com/justice. Policies issued by Western Southern Life Insurance Company. Not available in certain states. Price is subject to underwriting and health questions. The next day, September 26th, the police heard from a confidential informant that C.J. Rice might have been involved in the shooting outside the brownstone. And so, the police went to talk to Latisse again, armed with an 8-pack photo array, with one of those photos being of C.J. Rice. And now, for the very first time, Latisse would identify C.J. as one of the shooters. According to Latisse, she saw C.J.'s braided hair sticking out of the right side of his hoodie. And while the shooter was wearing a hoodie, Latisse said his whole face was visible because he was standing near streetlights at the time of the shooting. This was the man whom Latisse had claimed she saw running away after the shooting. Now, as we noted, CJ and Latisse's son Khalif had been friends until middle school, and Latisse had seen him on several occasions. In fact, they were Facebook friends. All of this lent credibility to Latisse's identification of him, but they also called into question why she couldn't identify him on the night of the shooting. This wasn't the only identification in the case, though. Another family member outside the brownstone during the shooting was Latisse's 23-year-old daughter, Latoya Lane. She was able to identify the second shooter as Tyler Linder. Going back to the initial shooting, you might recall that Tyler was the one riding bikes with CJ when the car rolled up and a passenger opened fire on them. And so, this is where you see the state's theory of motive starting to come together. Back on September 3rd, someone shot at CJ and Tyler. It might have been Khalif Ladson, or CJ and Tyler might have come to believe that it was Khalif. And so, about 3 weeks later, according to the state, they returned the favor, going to his brownstone and opening fire. But there was a pretty big problem for the state, one that led to a jury easily acquitting Tyler of the late September shooting at the brownstone. You see, Tyler's mother was a maid, and on the night of the shooting, she had a big cleaning job at Allegheny Iron and Metal. Luckily for Tyler, both he and his brother accompanied their mother to help her with a job, which was 10 miles away from the shooting, with a job starting before the shooting and ending after it. Now, it's unclear if the jury would have believed uncorroborated alibi testimony by Tyler's mother and brother, but they didn't have to. Surveillance footage from Allegheny Iron and Metal showed Tyler, his mother, and his brother both working the job and leaving at about 10 p.m., about half an hour after the shooting. And so, the jury didn't just have to believe testimony by Tyler's brother and mother. And speaking of Tyler's mother, she testified at trial that she drove by CJ the day before the brownstone shooting. And, according to the mother, CJ was walking slowly and was in obvious pain. This is totally consistent with what was said by CJ's godmother and her son, with whom CJ was staying on the night of the shooting. Like his friend Tyler, CJ had an alibi for the shooting. Gaddafi, the son of CJ's godmother, said they were together all night, including watching a movie on Netflix. Unfortunately, Gaddafi's mother wasn't home on the night of the shooting, meaning there was apparently no one and nothing to corroborate this alibi. But the godmother did accompany CJ to the police station on September 27th, 2011, when CJ voluntarily turned himself in on an arrest warrant for the brownstone shooting. While at the police station, officers noted that CJ was walking gingerly and was in obvious pain. But they would not and did not note something else. According to CJ's godmother, She informed the officers that she wanted to tell them about CJ's alibi, namely, that her son had been home with him on the night of the shooting. But she says the police refused to talk to her or take down any of her information about the alibi. Now, none of this might have been an issue if CJ had competent counsel, but he didn't. CJ was represented by court-appointed attorney Sanjay Weaver. Now, notably, a court-appointed attorney is different from a public defender, which is a salaried position. A court-appointed attorney is assigned cases by the court, and Weaver and many other court-appointed attorneys are paid a flat rate per case. In other words, someone like Weaver might get $500 to handle a felony case, no matter how complex it might be. And as you might imagine, this leads many court-appointed attorneys to do the bare minimum, especially if they're handling too many cases. This was certainly the case with Sanjay Weaver, and with good or bad reason. This episode of Undisclosed Toward Justice is brought to you by Wildgrain. Wildgrain is the first baked from frozen subscription box for sourdough breads, artisanal pastries, and fresh pastas. Plus, all items conveniently bake in 25 minutes or less. Unlike many store-bought options, Wildgrain uses simple ingredients you can pronounce and a slow fermentation process that can be easier on your belly and richer in nutrients and antioxidants. There's no preservatives and no shortcuts. Wildgrain's boxes are fully customizable. In addition to their variety box, they have a gluten-free box, a vegan box, and a new protein box. Recently, I had a delivery from Wildgrain, absolutely delicious. Buttery, bakery-quality croissants. And for those of you who follow me on social media, you see I've tried my hand on baking my homemade sourdough bread. I take no shame in saying Wildgrain sourdough absolutely blows my homemade option out the door. There's nothing like having an artisan bakery in your freezer to chase away the winter chill. Now is the best time to stay in and enjoy comforting homemade meals with Wildgrain. I highly recommend giving Wildgrain a try. And right now, Wildgrain is offering our listeners $30 off your first box, plus free croissants for life, when you go to wildgrain.com/justice to start your subscription today. That's $30 off your first box and free croissants for life when you visit wildgrain.com/justice, or you can use the promo code justice at checkout. You see, 9 months before being appointed to represent CJ, Weaver had filed for Chapter 13 bankruptcy. According to court records, in March of 2011, mere months before the shooting, Weaver had declared she only had $400 in her bank accounts, versus nearly $130,000 that she owed creditors, as well as being behind on her mortgage. And so, to try to keep afloat, she took on a lot of cases. Too many cases. Her conduct reminded me of Christina Gutierrez in the Adnan Syed case, who was juggling far too many cases when she represented Adnan. And the two lawyers were tied together by illness. Gutierrez died soon after representing Adnan due to multiple sclerosis, and Weaver died soon after representing CJ from dementia. It's unclear whether Weaver was showing signs of dementia at the time of trial, although she did refer to CJ by the wrong name at least once at trial. What we do know is that Weaver visited CJ only twice when he was locked up before trial. Both of these visits lasted just 15 minutes. During the first one, CJ asked Weaver to bring all the discovery files from his case so he could review them. At the second meeting, Weaver brought a big stack of papers, but none of them were for CJ's case. Instead, they were for other clients she was visiting at the correctional facility that same day. Now, this wasn't CJ's only attempt to develop his defense. There are recordings of phone calls that CJ made to his mom while he was locked up. On them, he practically begs his mother to get his lawyer to subpoena the records from his cell phone. CJ can be heard saying on the calls that the cell tower pings will place him by his godmother's house in West Philadelphia at the time of the shooting in South Philadelphia. Weaver, though, never did get those records, which were deleted by AT&T when they bought Cricket Wireless in 2014.
Overall, it's unclear whether Weaver put in more than a few hours on CJ's case. Case in point is her handling of CJ's injuries. As you'll recall, after surgery and staples being put in and taken out at the hospital, CJ was seen by Dr. Theodore Tapper 5 days before the second shooting outside the brownstone. Weaver did call Dr. Tapper at trial, but she did no witness prep with him. Dr. Tapper said he's testified in dozens of cases and has always been prepped by attorneys before trial, but not Weaver. She didn't speak with him until he arrived to testify at trial. Nonetheless, Dr. Tapper did testify to the trouble that CJ had walking or even moving, as well as his opinion that CJ could not have walked upright, let alone run, 5 days after he saw him. And recall that Latisse Johnson, the witness who identified CJ, said that the suspect quickly ran away after he shot at her. Beyond that, Dr. Tapper was a pediatrician by training, not the surgeon who performed his surgery or someone who could give a specialized testimony about CJ's ability to walk or run. Weaver didn't call any of the medical personnel who treated CJ at the hospital or an expert witness on how CJ's injury or stapling would have affected his gait. She also didn't introduce any of CJ's medical records into evidence. Also, recall that on the night of the shooting, Latisse told police officers, doctors, and nurses that she could not identify the shooter and maybe only heard gunshots rather than seeing the shooter. Weaver called none of them to testify. Although, in fairness, it's not entirely clear how much of this the prosecution turned over as part of discovery. And so, despite an alibi and Dr. Tapper's testimony that CJ was incapable of committing the crime, CJ was convicted of 4 counts of attempted murder. At sentencing, Weaver asked for a total sentence of 7 to 14, speaking to CJ's potential, including completing his high school studies while behind bars. The prosecutor countered that CJ should receive 7 to 14 years for each count of attempted murder, with the sentences running consecutively, in other words, back to back, as opposed to concurrently, in other words, at the same time. In the end, the judge imposed a sentence of 30 to 60 years, siding with the prosecution. In doing so, the judge turned Weaver's argument against her, noting that despite CJ's intelligence and promising future, he decided to shoot at women and children. Next, fast forward 5 years after the shooting to 2016, when one of three critical events occurred that set into motion CJ's eventual exoneration.
Now that the holidays are over, you might be feeling you've got a big spending hangover. The drinks, the holiday food, the gifts, it all adds up. Luckily, Mint Mobile is here to help you cut back on overspending on wireless this January with 50% off unlimited premium wireless. Mint Mobile's end-of-year sale is still going on, but only until the end of the month. Cut out big wireless's bloated plans and unnecessary monthly charges with 50% off 3, 6, or 12 months of unlimited. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Now, the great thing about having Mint Mobile here in Columbia, South Carolina, is that its coverage map is the same as the other wireless services, but at a fraction of the cost. And I'm sure that the same applies to many other areas where our listeners live. This January, quit overspending on wireless with 50% off unlimited premium wireless. Plans start at just $15 a month at mintmobile.com/undisclosed. That's mintmobile.com/undisclosed. Limited time offer, upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12-month plan required, $15 a month equivalent, taxes and fees extra, initial plan terms apply, greater than 50 gigabytes may slow when network is busy, capable device required, availability, speed, and coverage varies, see mintmobile.com.
He sent a letter to Dr. Tapper, asking for help in retrieving his hospital records, which again were not presented to the jury by his attorney at trial. Dr. Tapper got those records and saw the extent of the damage to CJ's pelvis, which was even worse than he had realized when he had treated him. And so Dr. Tapper made it his personal mission in life to help set CJ free. Through the work of Dr. Tapper and CJ's appellate attorneys, some critical things came to light. First, there was the light. You might recall that Latisse Johnson said she could see CJ's face so well because he was standing by a bright street light. This claim is contradicted by crime scene photos, which show that the street was dimly lit, making it difficult to see something like a face. Second, there was distance. As noted, Latisse testified at trial that the shooter was only 20 feet away from her. A visit to the crime scene shows the shooter was 60 feet away based on the distance between the stoop and the curb where shell cartridges were found. Third, there was obstruction. Latisse said that she saw the men coming from Fernand Street to 18th Street South while she was sitting on her stoop. But crime scene photos show that there were two vehicles that would have blocked her view and precluded her from seeing what she said she saw. Fourth, there's the reliability of Latisse's ID, which wasn't explored at trial. As you might recall from our Daryl Ewing series, two big factors that undermine eyewitness IDs are weapon focus and inability to see a hairline. In that case, the eyewitness said that the shooter was wearing an Elmer Fudd-esque hat and he was focused on the gun. Here, Latisse said she was focused on the sparks coming from the shooter's hand as he fired the gun and that the shooter was wearing a hoodie. This takes us to the fifth and most critical point, that hoodie. You'll recall that Latisse didn't give a description of the shooter or identify anyone on the night of the shooting. But then, the next day, she picked CJ out of an 8-pack photo array and said she saw CJ's braided hair sticking out of the right side of his hoodie. Well, there was a big problem with this. When CJ was arrested 2 days after the shooting, his hair was in cornrows. And according to certified hairstylists who are experienced with black clients, based on the visible fraying and wear of CJ's cornrows in his mugshot, his hair had been styled that way for 3 to 4 weeks prior to the photo. So no, CJ did not have braided hair on the night of the shooting. But guess what? CJ did used to have braided hair, including in the photo that was shown to Latisse when she identified him from the photo array as the shooter on the day after the shooting. Now, was this an innocent mistake and memory contamination, or was it police misconduct? We can't say for sure because there was basically no recording of what was done during Latisse's identification of CJ. And so, all of these are pretty juicy issues. And they weren't the only ones. But appeal after appeal failed for CJ until he had exhausted all of his state appeals.
This takes us to July 18th, 2020. As we noted, Dr. Theodore Tapper was CJ's physician. Well, Dr. Tapper is the father of Jake Tapper, the CNN anchor. For years, Jake had wanted to publicize CJ's case, but his attorney at the time was gun-shy. It looked like CJ's only option at the time was a reduction in sentence or early release, and publicly proclaiming CJ's innocence could cause issues in that front. But then, on July 18th, 2020, the second critical event leading to CJ's exoneration took place. Jake Tapper decided to post about CJ's case on Twitter to see if anyone could help. Specifically, he wrote, "Speaking of fighting injustices, my father, Philadelphia pediatrician Dr. Ted Tapper, has been trying for years to get justice for CJ Rice, a former patient locked up in a Pennsylvania prison since 2012 for a crime my dad is convinced he could not have committed. Fortuitously, I happened to be on Twitter at the time and responded, 'I'd be interested in investigating this case. Please let me know how I can contact your father and or you. Thanks.'" Now, this is the part of the story where you, the listener, comes into play. Jake Tapper didn't know about Undisclosed, and I easily could have seen him being skeptical about us handling the case. But below my tweet, tons of listeners like you told Jake Tapper about the work we did and our results. Then, I realized this was a Philadelphia case. And so, I was able to share some of our success stories working with DA Larry Krasner's office and working wrongful conviction cases in Philadelphia, such as the Chester Holman case that Robbie brought to the podcast and the Willie Vesey and Terrence Lewis cases that I brought to the podcast. For me, the Terrence Lewis case was especially interesting because, like CJ, Terrence thought his only option was a sentence reduction before a judge reviewed the evidence that we and his legal team had found to declare him actually innocent. And so, in the back of my head, I wonder whether we could somehow work out a way for CJ to be declared innocent as well. This then led to the third critical event leading to CJ's exoneration. Starting the year with a wardrobe refresh? Quince has you covered with luxury essentials that feel effortless and look polished. They're perfect for layering, mixing, and building a wardrobe that lasts. Their versatile styles make it easy to reach for them day after day. Quince has all the staples covered, from soft Mongolian cashmere sweaters that feel like designer pieces without the markup, to 100% silk tops and skirts for easy dressing up, to perfectly cut denim for everyday wear. Their wardrobe essentials are crafted to last season after season. Their Italian wool coats are real standouts. They're beautifully tailored, soft to the touch, and built to carry you through years of wear, not just one season. The quality shows in every detail, the stitching, the fit, the fabrics. Every piece is thoughtfully designed to be your new wardrobe essential. And like everything from Quince, each piece is made with premium materials and ethical, trusted factories, then priced far below what other luxury brands charge. A few months ago, I ordered the organic stretch corduroy chore jacket from Quince, and I loved it for a few weeks, but then my wife stole it from me, and she now uses it as her go-to jacket when traveling. And it's easy to see why. When I wore it, it had silky lining in the arms, which felt nice in my elbows, and we got it in the warm brown, which goes with everything. Overall, it has that soft and comfy feel that made me feel great during the winter holidays. Refresh your wardrobe with Quince. Don't wait. Go to quince.com/tourjustice for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada too. That's quince.com/tourjustice to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/tourjustice. At the time, I was working the Darrell Ewing case that we had mentioned a minute ago on the podcast. Also working on Darrell's case was my South Carolina student and research assistant, Abigail Gowdy. Because my bandwidth was taken up by Darrell's case, I asked Abigail to take a first pass at CJ's case, looking through every single file, soup to nuts. She dutifully did, and came back to me with something that every one of the prior attorneys who had handled the case had missed. Out of the entire haystack of the case file, she pulled out the needle that would eventually be threaded into an exoneration. Specifically, here's the heart of what she wrote in her initial report in the case to me back in September of 2020. It is odd to me that police, detectives, and the state did not do more to pursue testimony from Cleef. I am also perplexed that we do not know the root of whatever caused CJ to be shot and why the police think it was Cleef. Surely there is a motive lying around somewhere, so I would like to know why it was never discussed or contemplated during the investigation. Breaking that all down, you'll recall that the state's theory of the case was that Cleef Ladson was the one who had shot CJ while he was riding his bike, and that this formed the motive for CJ to shoot up Cleef's brownstone. And yet, as Abigail noted, there was no there in this case, either the case file or at trial. True, at trial, the prosecution powerfully proffered this theory, but there was nothing to back it up. No evidence the anonymous tipster who said Cleef was the shooter. No evidence that anyone outside the police force knew that Cleef was a suspect in the shooting. No evidence that CJ knew or even believed that Cleef was the shooter. So what's the issue with this from an evidence law perspective? There's a concept in evidence law known as conditional relevance. It says that sometimes at trial, the relevance of evidence depends upon some conditional fact. Take this case. The fact that the state presented at trial was that Cleef had shot CJ, or at least was a suspect in the crime. And the relevance of that fact was that it gave CJ a motive to kill Cleef. But there's an intermediate fact that needs to be presented to get the theory before the jury. And that intermediate or conditional fact is knowledge. Because in the absence of evidence that CJ knew or believed that Cleef was the shooter, this evidence and the state's whole theory of motive should have been deemed irrelevant and inadmissible. So you might ask, what happened at trial? Well, Abigail and I dug deeper and learned something shocking. CJ's attorney, Sanjay Weaver, had stipulated to the admission of this evidence in theory at trial. Yep. Rather than objecting, or even simply remaining silent, Weaver affirmatively assented to this theory and evidence being introduced against CJ at trial. This was a shocking dereliction of duty and a clear example of ineffective assistance of counsel. And so, We worked up the argument and found federal precedent supporting the claim that this was grounds for a federal petition for writ of habeas corpus. Because while CJ had exhausted all of his appeals in state court, he still had the chance to file in federal court. We sent what we had found to CJ's attorney, and December 2022, CJ's new legal team eventually filed a federal habeas petition, citing the conditional relevance issue that my student Abigail was the first to uncover, making it my proudest moment ever as a professor.
Now, as you all know from this podcast, when the defense files an appeal, you always prepare for the worst. The state filing a vigorous opposition and the judge agreeing with them, especially with the high bar set for federal habeas review. But guess what? That didn't happen. Instead, the state agreed with the theory that Abigail and Colin had proposed. With regard to the trial prosecution's evidence and theory regarding Khalif Ladson shooting CJ, the state wrote the following. Quote, as a hearing 2 days before trial made clear, the evidence was inadmissible at trial because the prosecution could not establish any foundation for it, i.e. how the police concluded that Ladson was a person of interest, the response said. Instead of keeping the damaging fact out of the trial, trial counsel handed the prosecution a gift, allowing them to introduce a, quote, extremely, extremely important piece of its case without any adversarial testing. And so, with the state and defense in lockstep, on October 23, 2023, U.S. Magistrate Judge Carol Sandra Moore Wells recommended granting Rice's habeas petition. She wrote that, quote, trial counsel's failure to apprehend this crucial point of state evidentiary law and the absence of any strategic reason for entering into the stipulation constituted deficient performance. About a month later, U.S. District Court Judge Nitza Alejandro accepted this recommendation and granted relief. On December 19, 2023, CJ was released from prison after about 12 years of wrongful imprisonment. And that then left the question of whether DA Larry Krasner would take the case back to trial or drop the case forever. He chose the latter option in March 2024. And this is where the modern motive and the old French motif come into play. Without Weaver's stipulation, there was no motive for CJ to kill Khalif. And then recall that the old French word motif meant having control of motion, causing motion, having power to move someone or something. Well, now there's a wealth of medical evidence to show that CJ did not have control of motion on the night of the shooting. That because of his shattered pelvis and surgery, he could barely walk on the night of the shooting, let alone run. Moreover, in dropping the charges against CJ, Krasner cited the oddness surrounding Latisse Johnson's identification of CJ, including her saying she saw his hair braided despite CJ most certainly having cornrows on the night of the shooting.
With CJ now free forever, Jake Tapper set up a GoFundMe for CJ, which I and many others shared in social media. It's still up, with generous people, including many undisclosed listeners, having contributed just over $118,000 to date. And CJ's putting that money to good use. In 2024, he graduated from the Morca Georgetown Paralegal Program, and he hopes to attend law school. That would put him on the same path as Darrell Ewing, who is currently attending law school. Meanwhile, Abigail Gowdy, who worked both of these cases, is now a public defender, fighting the good fight. And then there's a final postscript. After being released from prison, CJ got married. And in December 2025, CJ's wife gave birth to a baby boy. They named him Theodore after Dr. Theodore Tapper, who fought for CJ's freedom for so many years, facing setback upon setback, until through sheer force of will, a terrific team of lawyers, and the discovery of a South Carolina law student, CJ finally found freedom.
Hey, Undisclosed listeners, it's Meethal, executive producer of Undisclosed Toward Justice. Before I roll through the credits, I've got a few quick notes. By now, most of you probably know about our Facebook community group. If you haven't joined yet, please go to facebook.com/groups/toward justice and answer 3 simple questions and you're in. But seriously, answer the questions because a bunch of you are still pending since you've only answered 1 or 2. They're easy questions, I promise. In addition to engaging with us through the Facebook group, you can also leave us a voice note at speakpipe.com/undisclosed. We always check the messages, and so far, I think we've answered all of them. We also have a Patreon page with three different tiers of perks, the lowest one just being a dollar, which allows us to continue to do this work. Other tiers include bonus episodes, early access to merch, and even joining Rabia in a live true crime Zoom discussion. Just go to patreon.com/undisclosedpod. Now, onto the real credits. A huge shout out to Hannah McCarthy for audio production. Thank you to Patrick Cortez and Romero Marquez for our theme music. For anyone new here, you can engage with us online by going to Instagram or Facebook at Undisclosed Podcast. We're also on TikTok, YouTube, and X at Undisclosed Pod. Whether you're a new or returning listener, you can always check out our previous cases and bonus episodes by going to our website at undisclosedpod.com. If you would like to follow Colin and Rabia on social media, you can find Rabia at RabiaSquared2 on Instagram and Colin at EvidenceProf on Instagram, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you all for your continued support and for supporting all of our sponsors. Until next time.
The new Wegovy pill is now available through Weight Watchers. Powerful GLP-1 results in a simple pill at the lowest price available. And with Weight Watchers, you can get doctor support and personalized nutrition programs. See if you qualify at weightwatchers.com. Ad not reviewed or approved by Novo Nordisk.